Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
And we are back. It's a Monday that we're recording these episodes.
Feels weird. We are recording, not to date the episodes, but we're recording on Memorial Day.
Yeah. These three-day weekends kind of throw us off with recording sometimes. But you've had a busy weekend, and this was the only time that we had to record. So we got to do what we got to do.
That's right. I had birthday parties and brunches and all sorts of stuff going on this weekend, and I was cooking for all of it. It was a hell of a day. John, I did not go to sleep until 5:30 a.m. Saturday night.
What the fuck?
I guess Sunday morning, technically.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you why. Thank you for asking.
Yep.
It was my brother's birthday, and we're celebrating his 40th.
Yep.
So we had a big to-do at our parents' house. Cooked a bunch of steaks. Cooked 24 steaks for people. Beautiful steaks. And after that, we decided, obviously, we're going to go out to the bars.
Sure.
We went to about three different bars, and then someone had the genius idea to go to one of Atlanta's most beloved establishments, the Cheetah.
Oh, boy.
Yes, the Cheetah. Oh, boy. The Cheetah Gentlemen's Club, to be more exact. And first time I'd ever been there, I'm not a huge strip club person, but I won't say no.
I mean, look, if Atlanta is known for a few things, it's wings and strippers. So.
Yeah, well, we got some good strip clubs around here. I was trying to get them to go to Magic City, but they did not want to do that.
Your family is too white to go to Magic City.
A little too white for Magic City, and that's fine.
I would love to just like drop your entire family in the Blue Flame Lounge and just watch them.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, I don't know. That might not have been a good night. Oh, man. But it was a lot of fun. And afterwards, we just hung out at the Airbnb that my brother and sister-in-law had rented. And I was talking with my brother. And before I knew it, it was 5:30.
Before you knew it, the sun was coming up.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, my God, I have got to go to bed. So Sunday, yesterday, was a complete write-off for me.
Yep.
I don't think I woke up until about 2 p.m., which is crazy. Now,
that's like me time.
I know. Like our dear listenership won't know this about me, but I am very much a early to bed, early to rise person. So this was like my one night of the year where I think I pulled basically an all-nighter.
Probably did.
Yeah. So, I'm feeling like a normal human again right now, thankfully. But it's still been a rough weekend, so I appreciate the flexibility on record times.
Yep. Well, we do what we do. Yeah. Or we do what we must.
Because we can.
The cake is a lie.
I just made a video game reference,
you
John.
You did, the one game that you like actually know.
Yeah. Oh, man, look at me.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling like a human now, because we're not talking about humans. At least not for the first couple episodes.
No.
Of this week's episodes of the Dune Minute.
Fair enough.
We're talking about some worms.
We
specifically a worm.
Yeah.
A very large worm. A grandfather worm.
Old man of the desert.
Yes. We are picking up where we left off. We are talking about minute 55 through 56 of Dune Part 2 by Denis Villeneuve. So to kind of catch back up to where we were, Paul last week had been tasked with his final rite of becoming Fremen.
Right.
He must, tame Shai-Hulud and ride the worm. He went up to a pretty large dune with a, specifically tuned by me from Stilgar Thumper, and accidentally called a worm that was a little too large.
I don't think it was an accident. I think we talked about this last week. I think Stilgar specifically wanted this to happen.
Maybe not that big. Because Stilgar said, whoa, not that big.
Yeah, so. Okay, fair. But I specifically think he tuned it to call
a big one. Oh, no, he definitely tuned a big one.
Yeah.
But not that big. And what do you know? Shai-Hulud likes to travel very quickly through the desert, crashes through a dune. And our minute starts with Paul just booking it to this, ravine in the dune where the worm is currently traveling through. This is his chance to, hop on and attempt to ride.
Yep.
So he's just hauling ass across the top of the sand, as Paul is wont to do running across sand with no issues.
Yeah. Right. And we can even see how loose the sand is.
Yeah.
Like as it's falling off the crest of this dune. So this definitely some movie magic that is allowing him to run so quickly and efficiently across the sand.
Sure. And as he's running, what do you know it? The ground slips out from underneath him and mm-hmm. he just begins to fall in towards this massive worm.
Yeah.
And
like through the divot that it's left on the top of the dune. Yeah.
And this is, you know, obviously a very high risk kind of moment because Paul is now between a wall of sand and the worm that is seemingly moving a lot faster than the ones that we've seen move before.
I was wondering if that was going to get brought up this week, like the 30 miles an hour, 27 point, whatever it was.
I mean, you're reading a little into my notes, but okay. We'll go into it now. There's no specific math that we can do on this one like we could for part one.
No.
However, in the extras for the Blu-ray, there's mention of how there's this 50-foot tall worm traveling at about 50 miles an hour. Oof. So this one is moving a little faster.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever stood next to a car that's going 50 miles an hour. It's a lot faster than you would think.
Yeah. Stood next to some trains that were probably in that vicinity.
Yeah.
But never a worm.
Paul's out here just kind of, you know, flailing with his maker hooks, hoping to catch and snag onto something. And he does, thankfully, you know, he does catch the rough skin of Shai Hulud. And, you know, as Paul, you know, pulls on the hook, we see that a flap of Shai Hulud's skin, you know, kind of pulls up a little bit.
And we get whole, John. Dune Part 2 is showing whole.
God damn it. Yes, we get whole. We get multiple holes, actually.
Shai Hulud continues the theme of being the world's worst fleshlight. And we see like these, like, I don't know what you want to call them, like little, they look like hairs, like inside the orifice that we get to see.
Yeah. I mean, they're sensory hairs to determine, you know, whether or not that part of the skin is exposed, because what these holes are, according to Art and Soul and according to some of the extras, are vent holes for Shai Hulud to, you know, vent off its internal heat and everything, so it's not completely cooking itself from the inside. That's as good. It's going through the desert.
Man, evolution's crazy.
Yeah. But instinctively, Shai Hulud wants to protect those, so it kind of rolls itself over to keep those holes from being exposed for too long or anything.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get glimpses on how the worm is controlled here.
Yeah.
Paul, you know, realizes this as well. And Shai Hulud is actually, I don't know if you had the subtitles on, but it says that Shai Hulud growls when the holes are exposed. So like it knows like, hey, fuck it.
Yeah.
Turn over, do this. And as the worm is turning, we start to see for the first time sunlight again.
Exactly.
Because as Paul had been falling through, the sand is so thick and so dense that it's just completely blocking out the sun. Mm-hmm. So not only are you trying to fight for your life and not get crushed by this giant worm, but you're doing it effectively in the dark. It's not a good time.
Well, and I have to say this, like this was a pretty ungraceful mounting of the worm.
Oh yeah. No, he completely like loses his footing and falls out from underneath him.
I have to imagine a much more experienced rider probably wouldn't go through this ordeal.
Sure. Yeah. Someone like Stilgar, who's been doing it his entire life.
Since he was 12, I guess.
Yeah. knows a little more about the graceful mount and dismount. But yeah, and you know, as Paul is beginning to turn the worm, he's not entirely vertical. He's, you know, I would say like a 70-ish degree angle.
Yeah. And we get some clever like camera work here where it looks like the camera is like from the POV of the worm's skin, like its outer shell or whatever you want to call it. And we just see like gravity shift for Paul as it's turning. So our perspective doesn't change, but Paul starts to like float up in the air as he's going up.
Well, yeah. Cause so he has a moment of respite from like all the chaos that was just happening where like it's nice and quiet. And then the worm bumps into something and it just like kind of flings him up in the air.
Yeah.
For a quick second. almost knocks him off. But then, you know, Paul eventually finds another spot for his hook to, you know, fall into the skin, tries pulling again to kind of get his bearings and everything on the worm. And that's where our minute ends.
That's right.
With the maker hook pulling on a flap.
That's right. Now, I just have a little bit about the book, because as important of a scene as this is, and there's a whole chapter dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. It's not all that different, or at least the initial worm riding scene is not all that different from what we see in the movie. There's a couple details which I'll sprinkle in, but most of this chapter is really just a conversation between Paul and Stilgar that we do not get in the movie.
Yeah.
So one thing that I thought it was interesting that they called this out in the book is worms have essentially a handedness, like where they favor a particular side of their body.
Pretty sure most animals do.
Well, okay. Well, worms are tubes.
Sure.
So they,
but they still have a particular side of their body that they probably.
Well, and one side is more often like in the sand, like on the bottom. One side's on the top.
Yeah.
So one thing that Stilgar points out to Paul is that, you know, you need, this is, you know, after they get done with the riding, or as they're riding later, he said, do you know what side we're on? And Paul has to like look down and he notices that, you know, as he looks to one side and looks to the other, the ridges, I forget what they call them in the books, but, they're like smoother as they go across. So he could tell that he found the top side of this worm because the ridges haven't been worn down by friction. So I thought it was a little interesting fun fact about worm. They prefer one side to the other.
Don't we all? There's a lot that is just going on in this entire sequence, in this entire scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to do my best to split up my art and soul notes across, you know, each minute of this week. If I leave something out or if I accidentally jump ahead, don't crucify me. Sorry.
I will forgive you in advance.
There are some fun notes that I have, though, about this minute in particular. And I want to start with Paul being on top of the dune and his running. Mm-hmm. You know, his conveniently well-skilled sand running, we'll call it.
Sure.
In Art and Soul, there are some aerial photography bits of how they did the practical effects for Paul slipping and falling into the dune. Art and Soul talks about how there was a lot of work that went into figuring out how to help make this as realistic as possible and not just like be on a green screen soundstage, having like a Hobbit kind of situation where Ian McKellen is talking to a tennis ball.
As Denis Villeneuve is wont to do, as much as possible is practical.
Right.
Which we appreciate.
Yeah. In the Blu-ray extras, he talks about how he can't imagine himself not doing a film without Paul Lambert, who is his VFX supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them work together to make things as practical as possible. And in doing so with this, what they did was they took these giant steel tubes and would bury them under the sand and then pull them out with like construction equipment to help.
Okay, yeah,
you know, create that sand falling out from under you kind of thing.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. And Timothy Chalamet's...
I'm picturing like the curvy metal that like a sewer tube is.
I mean, it's basically that. Okay. Yeah. What they ended up setting on were three of these giant tubes to move enough sand to replicate the general size of this worm here.
Very cool.
Timothy Chalamet's stunt double, Lorenz Hideyoshi, was the person that would, you know, then fall into.
Dude, major props to that guy.
Dude, shout out to all stunt doubles. Like, yeah, they seriously get their asses handed to them left and right for making all these movies and stuff. And, you know,
the true heroes.
Honestly, like, I mean, I know that, you know, their union medical is probably insanely good.
Sure.
But I hope it's really good, because I'm sure there's broken fingers and, you know, arms and legs all the time. Yeah, so
absolutely.
But yeah, so there was a lot of practical effects with, you know, recreating this worm so that way the VFX doesn't take away from the actual film, it doesn't feel weird and out of place.
Yeah. It
almost just kind of adds as another layer to the film.
Gotcha.
And that's the way that Denis Villeneuve on many instances has talked about how he, you know, likes to make his films. I mean, you see that happen with the VFX in Arrival. You see it happen in Blade Runner and Dune Part 1 and Part 2. So,
yeah. And I want to
definitely also, sticks to his principles on that.
Yeah. I also want to give a big shout out to Andy Serkis playing the worm in this movie. I'm assuming it's Andy Serkis.
No, Andy Serkis is not playing Shia LaBeouf.
But would it be surprising if that came out as a thing that was true? Would you honestly be surprised?
No.
No, exactly.
Andy Serkis playing Edric?
That maybe could be good. We'll put that on the wish list.
I mean, Doug Jones is still my top, but I think Doug Jones has said, like, he's done doing that shit, so.
Yeah, which is a shame, because he would be perfect.
I think if you were going to cast Edric as anyone, you'd do Bill Skarsgård. He's got that fucking weird face and, like, super lanky body.
Yeah, yeah, he would be good.
What's one more Skarsgård?
I was like, that's just what Dune needs, another Skarsgård.
I mean, there's, like, 12 of them, so. Yeah.
I couldn't tell you their names.
Nope.
Cool. Well, anything else for this minute before we...
Yeah, I got a few things for this minute.
Okay, sorry. I spoke too soon.
Fucking taking my fucking thunder.
Sorry, were you going to make the Andy Serkis joke?
No. I was not going to make the Andy Serkis joke. I want to talk a little bit about practical Shia LaBeouf.
Okay.
Because Shia LaBeouf is a practical effect here. Shia LaBeouf is a 25-meter by 10-meter platform of, like, rubber skin, effectively.
Yeah.
That was lifted and moved across several different gimbal setups. Okay. So they had a gimbal for the rotation as Paul is, you know, first pulling on the flaps to, you know, begin to rotate up away from the ground.
Right.
They have a setup where effectively the Shia LaBeouf body was like resting at a steep angle against the side of a warehouse. And that's when Paul is falling down into the ravine and he's like clawing away for the skin of Shia LaBeouf.
All right,
Then we'll see, and we'll talk about it a little bit more as the movie or as the scene progresses, but another gimbal that would lift and also like rock side by side and forward and backwards as well.
Sure.
To help replicate the actual movements of the worm and everything.
Very cool.
So it's just a giant slab of worm skin that they created in Budapest and did all of this practical shooting in outside.
Sure.
You know, sure. Because they wanted to, you know, try and capture as much natural sunlight as possible instead of, you know, once again, CG replicating sunlight and, you know, having light boxes all over the place. So,
right. Yeah, I would have put money on this being a CGI thing. That's awesome.
There's more practical shots in here than you would think.
Good. Well, that's why it looks so damn good.
Yeah. The shots of Paul sliding down the dune were all practical as well, where Lawrence Hideyoshi would be pulled down a dune on a guide wire, and then about 5 feet behind him there's a cameraman also on another guide wire being pulled down. So they're getting the actual like sand rushing effects and everything
right.
in practical use as he's going down.
Man, that's so cool.
Yeah,
good on them.
Buy a copy of the Blu-ray. Watch the extras, because I can talk about this, but like unless you're actually watching how they filmed all this,
sure,
it gives you so much more appreciation for how these kinds of movies are made.
Yeah. Well, clearly they put a lot of love and effort into this.
Yeah. But those are all my notes for today. We're going to have a few more art and soul notes sprinkled out throughout the rest of the episode. So
awesome.
I say we go ahead and call it here, and we'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Dune Minute.
All right, cool. Let's do it.
As always, you can find us online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way. We'll be back with a Tuesday episode tomorrow. We'll see you later.
See ya.